Paul Snyder.
Do you have something you're going to say? Oh, you're not saying anything. No, you're just paving the way.
It was our president and our immediate past president, they just had some brief comments that they'd like to share with the subcommittee.
This is good. Well, we'll be in a very brief recess. Reconvene the Public Safety Subcommittee at a brief recess, and we're going to move into the corrections population forecast. So, Mr. Nicewinder,
yes.
Do you have any opening?
Chair Miller and committee members, today before you have Sue Porter from the Department of Administrative Services. The forecast, in the way of background, is issued twice a year, and this is their public release of that forecast. Sometimes they have press conferences, other times they'll do it in front of an interim legislative committee. Today you are given that honor of being the recipient of this public document. And,
well, good morning, and thank you for honoring us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Porter. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services and the Office of Economic Analysis, and I have the April 2001 Corrections and Youth Authority Population Forecast for you today. There's two of them. And as Larry said, we do these twice a year, and we also have committees that help us do these forecasts. There are people that work in the criminal justice and juvenile justice system, and some of them are here today. And the committee members are listed on the back of each document. I want to start with the corrections population forecast, and I'm going to be going through the executive summary, which is a few pages in. And the state-funded corrections population consists of prison inmates, the felony probation caseload, parole and post-prison supervision, and the population under local control. Those are the felons sentenced to 12 months or fewer that are in county custody but funded by the state. And those are the populations that we forecast. Starting with prison, we had 10,219 state prison inmates as of January 1st of this year. And we forecast that to grow by 4% by July 1st. And between January of this year and July 03, the end of the next biennium, we forecast 12.6% growth, which would put the population at 11,506. Through the whole 10-year period, we forecast 46% growth. And that puts the population at almost 15,000, 14,949 by January of 2011. And about 45% of that growth we attribute to indirectly or directly to Measure 11. And our current forecast, you can see in the table, it's compared to the previous forecast. And our current forecast is lower. It's 104 beds lower as the starting point, and it remains lower throughout the next biennium and throughout the rest of the forecast. The main reason for that is we had fewer than expected intakes last fall. So when January 1st came along, we were 100 beds lower than we thought we would be. So we apply the same amount of growth in both forecasts, and it's just we're starting at a lower point, so we never grow quite as high. On community supervision, parole and probation, this is the third time we forecast that population. And through the process, and working with Department of Corrections, we've made some changes for this forecast and the way that we go about it. First of all, the forecast starts with October 2000. As we've been working with this data for a year or so, we found that it takes about 4 months for all the data to be entered in the computers by out in the counties. That's where all these cases are put in the computer, out in the counties. So if we want to know what the population was on a given date, we have to wait 3 or 4 months and look back in time. So this is the first forecast where we're tracking to this different standard. And most of these community corrections forecasts start at quite a bit different from our last forecast, a bigger difference than we're used to working with. And that's due to tracking to a different standard. Starting with felony probation, which is at the bottom of the first page of the executive summary, we have 18,501 offenders on felony probation as of October 1st, 2000. And we expect that to grow by 1.6% over this biennium. And between October and the end of the next biennium, July 2003, we expect the population to grow by 4.5%, which would put it at 19,337. And over the course of the 10-year period, we forecast 15.7% growth. That puts the population at 21,400 as of October 2010. Mainly what's going on in the probation caseload over this coming biennium is there's not a lot of growth forecast there compared to other populations, and that's because in the last legislative session, there was passed House Bill 2002, and that, among other things, it made felony driving while suspended a misdemeanor. And at that time, there was about 1,000 or so offenders on probation with a felony driving while suspended sentence. And over the last biennium, that's dwindled down to about 650 as of October. And we expect those 650 offenders to finish their sentence and move off the caseload during the 2001-03 biennium. So that creates a hole that is, and that's going to be filled somewhat with increases in felony assault four, mostly domestic violence. That's been a growth area. And the other area of growth is felony drug possession, mostly C felony drug possession is another area of growth. But so.
Sure.
Senator Trow.
Just a question. The felony that we're now having for driving while suspended, is that one of those felonies that we count toward the major 11 crimes if somebody's convicted of that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow,
How many offenses do you get before they really get tough on you?
Well, on Measure 11, the criminal history doesn't matter. It's a mandatory minimum sentence, and if a person has a substantial criminal history, then they could add to it. And I'm not sure about other sentences under guideline. I think misdemeanors do count, but not to the extent felonies and person felonies count.
Now we're making driving while suspended a felony, so it would count.
It's a misdemeanor. It was a felony. It made it a misdemeanor.
Okay.
So that's why the caseload's going down, because we had 1,000 people that were on for felony. They're finishing their sentences and going away off the caseload.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Okay. I was confused.
On the next page is parole and post-prison supervision. And that caseload was 10,438 as of October 2000, and we expect that to grow by 3%. Over as of July 1st. And between October and July 03, the end of the next biennium, we forecast 10% growth, and that puts the population then at 11,515. Over the course of the entire forecast, we have 33% growth, which puts the population at 13,891 as of October 2010. What's going on with parole and post-prison supervision over this coming biennium is Measure 11 offenders now are inmates are starting to be released. We had our very first batch of Measure 11 inmates released last month in February. These are the first people that have completed an entire Measure 11 sentence and been released to the community. There were about six or so. That's going to grow over this year. So on the average for 2001, we'll have about 12 Measure 11 inmates per month released, and continue to grow over the next biennium. So when during calendar year 2003, there will be about 30 per month Measure 11 inmates released. And that's what's driving the growth in post-prison supervision caseload over the next biennium. For local control, that's the this lower box on page 2 in the executive summary, these are the felons sentenced to 12 months or fewer. They're in county custody but funded by the state. That population was 1896 as of last October, and we forecast that to drop a little bit to 1876 by the end of this biennium. And we forecast it to grow by 7.5% to just over 2,000 as of July 2003. And over the entire 10-year period, we have 25% growth, or 483 beds. And that puts the population at 2,379 as of October 2010. The little decline that we have over this first 6 months or so of the forecast is this population will kind of go up and down, fluctuates a little bit, and October 2000 happens to be a high point. And everything we see as far as the last part of 2000, the number of intakes went down again, so the population is moving down a little bit. This forecast it's higher than the last one throughout the biennium and the whole 10-year period, and part of that is due to tracking to a different standard, and the other part is due to the fact that we have more people on the probation caseload, and all our forecasts are interrelated. So if we have more people on the probation caseload, translates into a few more people in local control. Just about half the people that go into local control are revoked from probation. On page 3, there's a table that compares components of this forecast as of the beginning and the end of the coming biennium. All these forecasts, we break the population down into little groups and forecast them and add them all together to get the total. And all these groups are defined in Section 2 of the document. And there's in the main body, goes on, gives a forecast for each one. And in the back of the document, there's some tables that show the major components are broken down month by month over 10 years. It compares this forecast with the last one. The risk to this forecast, we're going out 10 years, and we're assuming current practice, current law, current policy over a 10-year period. So if we look back 10 or 11 years, we got sentencing guidelines, Measure 11, local control, repeat property, and a host of other smaller laws that had a smaller effect. The four I mentioned had major effects on the corrections population. And there are several bills pending before this legislative assembly that would affect the forecast. So if any of those pass, become law, we'll incorporate those into this forecast at the close of session. Do you want me to go into youth? Or?
I'll see if there are any questions on this particular forecast. Senator Troll.
If there were more widespread use of fast-track sentencing, would that have any effect on your analysis? We've been talking about that in committee. Maybe you haven't about that particularly. He knows about it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Troll, my name is Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney. Fast-track accountability wouldn't really change these numbers as such, and it would really be a processing issue in the trial courts, and it would help free up some county jail space, but it really wouldn't have an impact on these prison sentences.
Wouldn't either exacerbate the numbers or slow them down?
No, in my opinion, it wouldn't have any impact on it.
Other questions? Mr. Nicewind.
Sue, if you could speak to the committee briefly about the change in the ballot measure 11 forecast. When they first ballot measure 11 first passed, this was projected to be responsible for anywhere from, 75 to 80% of the growth. Now it's only responsible for about 45% of the projected future growth. And you could just talk about what you're seeing in terms of trends of how it's been implemented that caused that reduction in the growth rate.
Mr. Chair, part of this is as we move forward in time, we've already banked some growth behind us. The last forecast we did, 50% of the growth was due to Measure 11. As we've already have almost 4,000 Measure 11 offenders in prison, and a number of those would be in prison anyway, but a number of them would be out because their sentences would be shorter. So As we move forward in time, less and less of the future growth is attributed to Measure 11. If you want to talk about way back when, is it before the very first forecasts that were done with Measure 11, that assumed that people would continue to be sentenced for the same crimes that they were sentenced before Measure 11. So before Measure 11, say we had 300 or 400 people sentenced for assault two, and 40% of those went to prison and 60% got probation. The original models they used assumed that we would still have those same 400 people sentenced to assault two, and they would all go to prison and they would all get 70 months. And what we saw is there was the same amount of people went to prison for Measure 11 crimes. If we look before and after, we have about 60 people a month. There's no change to that. The change came in people that were sentenced for assault three or attempted assault one, just a shade removed. Those people probably used to get probation before Measure 11, but they were sentenced as, say, assault two, because it didn't matter what the what the crime was. You could charge and convict for the crime and use guidelines for the sentence. When Measure 11 came in, if they saw someone that probably didn't deserve a 7-year sentence, they would, but should be in prison nonetheless, they may have that person agree to plea to assault three and put them in prison for 3 years. So that's where the big differences came.
Senator Trow.
Do we make any assumptions about the recidivism rate for Measure 11 releasees, for instance? Are we expecting that they will be going back to prison more quickly than others or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, they are put in the risk pool with all prison releasees the way that we do our forecasts. We don't know enough about them yet to make any assumptions about whether they will be revoked at a more at a higher rate or faster, but it's something we're going to be watching over the next few years.
Now, if they are, since they have this history of previous crimes, does that mean that they would automatically get mandatory minimums and so would stay again a long time if they go back to prison?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, it depends on the crime they're charged with. Under guidelines, having a felony, person felony, is going to put them in a higher sentencing grid. And certainly if they're charged with another Measure 11 crime, I mean, the mandatory minimum stays the same, but I think what we've seen, at least before Measure 11, someone that came to the court with the second serious person crime was going to get a pretty long prison sentence.
Okay, why don't we move on to the other forecast, if you would, please.
The Youth Authority closed custody population forecast. Again, I'm going to be going through the executive summary. And when we talk about closed custody, we mean youth in correctional facilities like McLaren and Hillcrest, in youth accountability camps and work study. We don't cover youth that are in residential treatment, in group homes, or foster care. The main, another big distinction between this and the adult forecast is in the juvenile system, there are not determinate sentences. There's no set amount of time that a youth has to spend in closed custody. So the youth authority can work with counties and manage their population, prevent overcrowding. So when we forecast a population, it's not what it will be, but what it would be if we continued with current practice, looking at the demographics and changes in the crime and the arrest rate that we see. So it's a demand-based forecast. With that, the closed custody population was 1131 as of January of this year, and we forecast that to drop a little bit. In fact, it has already dropped by 1.2% to 1118 as of the beginning of the next biennium. And between January 2011 and July 2003, we forecast 6% growth, which would put the population at just about 1,200. as of July 2003. Over the entire course of the forecast, we have 21% growth, or 236 beds. That puts the population at 1367 as of January 2011. Our forecast is lower throughout the entire forecast horizon compared with our last forecast, and the explanation for that is over on the next page. There's a graph there that shows the Youth Authority's close custody population going back to January 1, 98. That's when we started doing their forecast. And 98, 99, there was a lot of growth, and that was due to Measure 11 and waived youth going into the Youth Authority. I mean, that population went up by over 100 during that time. And toward the end of 99 into 2000, that population has stabilized. There's around 320, 315 Department of Corrections transfers at the Youth Authority at any given time. And the growth, if you were to cover up the very last 6 months of the graph, when it starts to go down, that's where we were at last July when we did our last forecast, looks like another year of growth. That was coming from juvenile sex offenders. There were more of them, and they were staying a longer time. Everything else was the same. But we had this growth in juvenile sex offenders. Well, the second half of the year came along, and what looked like another year of growth turned out to be an unusually high seasonal spike followed by an unusual seasonal low. So we started and ended the year 2000 at virtually the same population. We're still seeing a lot of juvenile sex offenders, and they're staying a long time, but the number of juvenile property offenders has come down a little bit to make room. So we don't see the same kind of growth in Measure 11 that we had in earlier forecasts, but there is a kind of a demographic bubble of kids that are going to be reaching the Youth Authority's age in the next 4 or 5 years, and that's what's driving some of the growth in the forecast. Again, on page 3 is the same type of table as you saw in the adult corrections forecast. We forecast this, you know, divide the population into a bunch of little groups, forecast them all, and add them together. They're all defined in the document, and each forecast is shown separately. And again, on the back page is the current and previous forecast are compared month by month over 10 years. The rest of this forecast, the same as with the adult, there are several bills pending before the Legislative Assembly that could change the number of people in close custody. In addition, we have Senate Bill 555 that was passed in 1999. That was the crime prevention bill. As I understand it, most counties now have their juvenile crime prevention programs in place, some of them for longer than others. And we, with our committee, were really unable to say whether the drop that we saw in the last half of 2000 was, we could attribute that to Senate Bill 555. But it is something we're going to be watching closely over the next biennium. I mean, that was the purpose of Senate Bill 555, was to reduce the number of people committed to the Youth Authority. So we will be watching for any effect of that.
Questions? Senator Trowe.
Do we have any good idea of how much drug and alcohol influences criminal behavior among these folks, and whether or not changes in that policy would affect these numbers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trowe, do you mean the Youth Authority or everybody?
I'm meaning young people now, or everybody, either one.
Well, from what I hear from our committee, drug and alcohol are huge issues, and if anyone from the Youth Authority here, they could address that better than I, but that is a big part of their programming.
Thank you, sir. That's fine.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chairman Miller. In the risk to the forecast, there's mention of several bills have been introduced that could affect OIA's population. Does that also take into account the governor's proposal of placing greater emphasis on prevention rather than incarceration?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, no, we have not taken that into account in this forecast because it's not current policy yet. This is
probably an unfair question of you, but I'll ask it. If we're not able to address it, that's fine. If the governor's proposal were to move forward, what would be your prediction on the difference in your custody forecast, in placing greater emphasis on prevention rather than incarceration.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think, well, the immediate effect would be the closure of beds. I think that was part of that proposal. And I, if those beds close, I would guess that we're going to see fewer property offenders being sent to close custody.
10 years out or more.
And there's, as far as the juvenile sex offenders, the reason they go with more frequency to the youth authority and stay longer, as I've been told by our committee, is that they are hard to place anywhere else. So those are going to be the first priority. And property crimes would probably be the place where they would make room.
I'm going to have future questions, but not this. I'll have future questions, but not this.
Okay.
Chairman. Thank you.
Other comments, questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation. Okay, Mr. Snyder, you're back. Be glad to have your brief comments.
While they're coming up, I could comment briefly. These forecasts will be used to, for both these agencies to revise their governor's recommended budget to basically balance to the new forecast. In the corrections case, you saw some small reduction in the prison bed count, some increases in the community corrections population count, and those will be reflected in the revised budgets that will be placed before you later in session.
Ready.
All right. Please introduce yourself on our record, please. And
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Harold Haugen. I'm Josephine County Commissioner, past president of the Association of Oregon Counties. On my left is Commissioner Steve McClure from Union County, who is our current president of the Association of Oregon Counties. And on my right is our staff person, Paul Snyder. And I would like to say thank you for allowing us this opportunity to speak. I appreciate your working us into the schedule. I left this morning from Grants Pass at 3 o'clock to be here.
Oh, my goodness.
And because it's important. Not
well,
because
then
I'm
take
harder,
all the 6 minutes.
Actually, it's pretty good driving. It's pretty good driving that time of day.
It's amazing how you can do it 65.
That's for sure. Anyway, This issue of district attorney funding is very important to us as an Association of Oregon Counties and as counties across the state. All 36 of the counties have considered this one of our higher priorities on trying to deal with the issue. In Josephine County, back in the early 80s, we had a cap put on us in our jail of 64 people. And we tried to figure out how are we going to build another facility to deal with. And we brought in a consultant from Denver, Colorado, by the name of Dave Voorhees. And he did a study of Josephine County and our whole system, criminal justice system. And the bottom line result, what stuck in my mind all these years, I've been a county commissioner since 1981, except for a brief recess in 89 and 90. But the thing that stuck in my mind is, he says, you have to manage your system here in Josephine County because you only got 64 beds. And you're going to have to show the public that you are managing your system. You have to manage it with all parts of that system, the sheriff's department, the district attorney's office, your corrections department, your juvenile, and courts, as well as your city police and state police. So we created a group that was called the Criminal Justice Management Group in our community to work on that, to come up with a management philosophy to work as a system and not as independent entities, which has been happening over the years. And because of that, we were able to manage our population, so we kept ourselves out of the federal courts, but we also were able to develop some credibility where we eventually got a new jail, with the understanding and the commitment of those associations of groups of people that they would maintain the policies and procedures that they helped put together that built our facility. And when we talk of the Sheriff's Department, they have to have a set of policies and procedures as what are their people going to do on the street, who are they going to arrest. We had to define who our population was going to be. That's been very successful. And so I've carried that through the years, and I truly believe we need to really work hard as a state of creating that type of a system in the state. And I've got to tell you, it's probably going to be the most difficult thing to ever happen because you have three levels of government that you're dealing with, from the state, the county and the city. But I think it's a doable thing over a period of years. And quite frankly, the people that should be sitting at this table today to show that would be the Chief Justice, the Attorney General, the District Attorney Association, the Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police, our Corrections, OYA, ought to be all sitting at this table to talk about a system and how do we fund the system as a state in order to make it work. We believe right now the system is not equitable. It's out of balance. We're adding police officers. We may add courts. We're looking at indigent defense issues, and we're not addressing the public prosecution side of this. And so the system really isn't what we feel in an equitable basis. And that's our whole thrust, is that we really believe that we need to bring the state in and work as an equitable, equal partner in this prosecution side. The counties have been sort of carrying the ball on the prosecution and the attorneys, district attorneys, for the years. We're starting to run into some problems that we always have in the past. 1983, I had to cut, not me, but the Board of Commissioners cut $8 million out of our budget. Let me tell you, in a small little county, $8 million is a lot of money, and we lost a lot of people. But what we did at that time, we created a priority, and I established a priority system that I worked with. And that was have-to-haves, need-to-haves, and nice-to-haves. You can figure out which ones the have-to-haves are and which ones the need-to-haves and the nice-to-have. Need-to-haves, of course, are those that are need to support the have-to-haves. And that's what we used in helping to determine how we were going to fund and keep our structure in some kind of place and provide the kinds of services that our citizens needed. In this whole process, I think the people that are being left out of our system at this point are the victims. I think because of the fact that we don't have the numbers of prosecuting people and the ability to fund on the prosecutory side, that the victims are not realizing or receiving the types of services that they feel they should be getting. And that's why we see some of these measures coming in, I think, from the citizenry, is to trying to tighten up what happens to the people that are committing these crimes. I was listening to the comments earlier. The jail population that you're talking about and the folks in jail, all of those have had to have some kind of prosecutory involvement. And as those people move through our system, there's going to be more of that occurring. So I just believe that we need to, as a state and as a group of counties, come together in some kind of a partnership to provide some kind of an equitable funding level. And I think we as an association have been working real hard to see what are some of the efficiencies that could occur that may help balance this system out, not trying to damage any portion of the system, but bring the system and the groups within the system up to an equitable level. One of the comments made in the legislative fiscal office's summary on district attorney says district attorney's workloads are determined in large part by the number, complexity, and type of criminal arrests that occur. So if we're adding police officers or across the state, whether it's city police officers, whether it's state troopers, or whether it's county sheriffs, that's going to have an impact on our prosecutory capabilities. Some people say, well, you see the number of arrests are gone down, and that's probably true, but sometimes that may be happening because the counties and the jurisdictions don't have the personnel to deal with that, so people are not calling in or reporting some of these crimes anymore. So it doesn't make any sense for them to call in and not get any responses back. So the records and the statistics aren't showing some of those things. The prosecutory folks are maybe saying, there's no sense bringing these people in because we can't prosecute them. So all of a sudden you have some immunity going on because of some of the fiscal constraints that we have. And so those are all of the little mechanisms and issues I truly believe have got to be put on the table. And at some point in time, whether it's after this legislative session, as all of these agencies need to start sitting down and talking to each other and working, how do we function as a group of people and not independently, and not have the state police come in and 1 week and tell you what their needs are, and then the next week the courts come in and tell you what their particular needs are, because they're not connecting. I'm not sure they're connecting. I didn't sit in and listen to the testimonies, but I truly believe if everybody was sitting at the table, you would see a connection of what each one of them will do to the other as you move through this process. I truly believe we have needs for courts, but when you add judges, you also add an impact on the prosecution as well, because there needs to be district attorneys to, in some cases, man those new courts that are coming in or would be coming in that create that. So there's another impact that can occur. We all face the fiscal dilemmas. I know you're not quite sure yet what your revenues are going to be, and hopefully you're going to know in May. I know that there's probably, I'd love to have the additional $1.4 billion in new money that may be coming in, if you call it new money, but it may already be committed. We are facing a $2 million, somewhere close to a $2 million deficit, that we're going to be making some reductions this next couple of weeks. And that's going to impact our sheriff. It's going to impact our DA. We may take funding away, all our funding away from our parks. We're maybe reducing health. All of the things that have nice things to that need to be done in our community. But in order to maintain public safety as one of our high priorities, some of those things are going to be sacrificed. And so we truly believe that with the participation at a higher level financially than has been in the past, that we will be able to provide some of those services to the citizens that we all sort of serve. I also sit on the Senate Bill 6 committee. I think Dale Penn testified in regards to that. I sat with him as well in with the Attorney General. I'm also on the Criminal Justice Commission, and I don't know whether you've received a report, but you're going to receive one. And one of the things it says is Oregon's criminal justice system is a complex conglomerate involving hundreds of agencies, including private agencies, as well as the federal, state, county, city, and district governments. The system often involves multiple agencies within each level of government, with multiple elected appointed officials, each having their own budget and policies priorities. And so as you can see, we're talking about a very complex system that I think is going to need some help. And we would certainly hope that as you move through your evaluation of the programs that you're going to have to make some decisions on, that you really take a hard look at how can you help bring this system up to some equity so that they're all functioning in a good fashion, and I think providing the kind of services that the victims need to have as well. And I know that there's been some offer of some solutions or some ideas in dealing with efficiencies. Both the Dale Penn as a district attorney has provided some. One of those is fast tracking, accountability, and some possible structured sanctions. And again, we're not here, and I don't think anybody wants to take away somebody's ability to receive the proper services as they go through the system, whether they be the victim or whether they be somebody that's being charged with a particular crime. Our interest is that a system is in place that the citizens can be proud of, can feel safe with, that covers not only the metropolitan area, but can cover us as a rural community as well. And with that, I would sort of stop and say, have you got some questions?
I would certainly respond to the meeting idea of the different levels of government. Seems to me to be a very good idea. If it hadn't happened, it's long overdue. I can't imagine that we wouldn't want to facilitate that. And if it requires us to host such a meeting in the interim or something like that, I would guess that we'd certainly be pleased to, in our interim capacities, invite League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, and go through this coordination. I mean, it just makes sense.
Yes, it does. Mr. Chairman, as a matter of fact, I did have that meeting just as you talked about as an association president. I asked and sent out letters to all of the people within the state of Oregon that have some involvement with the criminal justice system, the mental health, health department, cities, and we did meet back in, I believe it was October at one point, to start to see how do we start moving forward. Part of the problem is in the case of the corrections and superintendent of police, their budgets had pretty much already been put in place, and they were committed to have to move the way they were instructed to move forward. But I think everyone in that room felt very strongly that it was well worth pursuing. Unfortunately, it was so late in the game that it wasn't something that could happen. But I do believe if the legislature took a lead in this and a leadership role and asked the parties to come together as a group of people to start talking about policies and procedures and how their policy and procedure will affect each other. The one thing that affected us at the local level, we had a sheriff when he took office, says, when I take office, everybody picked up on drunk driving is going to spend 72 hours in jail. That's a policy decision. And let me tell you, that has a tremendous impact on the rest of the system. And he made that statement without talking to anybody else about it. And fortunately, he was not able to make it happen. But it's that kind of discussion that you need to sit down and talk about. if the district attorney is going to do certain things within his office and direct his staff to do certain things, they need to know, the rest of the system needs to know that in advance so they can make some adjustments. And so I would certainly hope that in the future that there is a real desire to bring these parties together. And I think from a budgetary standpoint, I'll just give you an example at the local level, we provide a lump sum of money to our criminal justice people. So you have X number of dollars to put together to provide the services for the sheriff, the DA, corrections, and juvenile. Now you folks go out of the room and you come back and you tell us how you've distributed that money, and you have to all agree. Because as a board of commissioners, you probably really wouldn't want us making those calls. You're better suited to do that than we are. And it works. And it takes the load off of us to some degree of having to make those kinds of decisions that may not be sometimes the right one. It may put that thing out of balance. And if you can get them all in the same room talking and working together, and in some cases they may have to make some cuts, but they have to do that. Part of the issue will be turf. And how each other will eventually be willing to maybe have to give up a little for somebody else to gain a little. But I think in the future that that's possibly the best way to go.
And that's certainly not unprecedented for us to send people over to Mahonia Hall and meet in the basement until they've agreed to agree, and we take credit for their good work. Let me ask you in your own situation, then I'll recognize Senator Trow. You mentioned a $2 million reduction in...
in our overall budget.
Our budget is that now. Joseph, now up here, we describe reductions as a cut in the rate of growth. Is yours an actual reduction from current service level?
Revenue reduction, which will directly relate to service level reduction.
And the actual total amount of expenditures is declining?
Increasing.
It's increasing.
Our expenditures
declining
are increasing
at a slower
rate
than forecast. Thank you. Senator Trow?
Yeah, sort of related to that. It seems as though one of the important things is, what are we asking each of the levels of government to do right now, and what sort of resources are needed to get that done? And so if that kind of an assessment could be made, and then what else do we want and need for them to do, and what would the costs be for those, considering the trends that we have in terms of criminal activity and so forth. I think that would be good for the state to understand, and how is it we go about paying for those costs, and if we don't provide the right kind of criminal prosecution and activities of the sheriff in terms of arresting and detaining, sentencing, and so forth. What are the consequences of those kinds of things? You say victims. You see as being people who are not adequately cared for in this process. But my guess is there are other kinds of consequences as well. I think it would be good for somebody to assess all of that and have a good discussion of it, so we know what those costs are.
Yeah, Senator Miller, Chairman Miller, Senator Trow, I think one of the other consequences that we really don't measure is the lack of respect for the system. I think because people think they can go out and commit a crime and they get released because, one, they can't prosecute it, the sheriff deputy or the state trooper that goes out and arrests somebody and it turns out they have to turn them loose because they aren't going to be able to prosecute. What happens is that person has no respect for the system and figures I can do just about anything. That starts to, I think, spread out into the rest of our system. And I don't have any data and I'm not any expert in that area, but at some point in time you really create a real problem on respecting the system. And how do you fix it? I think this is one of the ways, is to start showing some.
Yeah, and I'm not convinced that just locking people up even for a longer period solves any problems, because I don't know that they come out any less inclined to go right back and commit crimes again. So what are we accomplishing by locking so many people up? We lock more people up in our society than any place in the world, and I don't think we have a more peaceful society because of it. So how do we get at that? I don't know.
Thank you. I don't know if Commissioner McClure may have something to add to that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Steve McClure, Union County Commissioner and President of AOC. Harold does an excellent job in his presentation. He's worked very hard at it, and there's not a lot to add. I would just add a couple of things. First of all, this has been a priority for our association. This will be the third legislative session that we've been dealing with this issue. It's been an important issue for counties for a number of years. And just to respond to Senator Troll's comment, the unspoken piece that's occurring right now in the state of Oregon is selective prosecution. I mean, there are crimes that are not being prosecuted right now because we can't fund the prosecution. We've had some discussions with the DAs. As a matter of fact, I was at a meeting this summer, and I suggested that maybe we list those things, and the DA didn't think it was a good idea to put out a handbook where you can commit certain crimes in the state of Oregon. So we didn't do that. But that's kind of the unspoken piece that we see out there. I think DA funding is an important piece of that. As Commissioner Haugen said, it's very complicated and complex. It even goes to the federal government. FAST grants, we all know what those are, and there's been a lot of additional police brought into the state with federal money. It just compounds the problem. The other unspoken piece is, as most of us know, drug and alcohol are an underlying cause with a lot of our criminal problems. And as you cut funding for those, that compounds it. So it is a very compounded, complex system that we try to deal with. And that's what we're asking to do is, as you make consideration for state agencies, local government is a part of this system. And we need to be considered in those funding decisions. If one agency of government was doing it across the board, it would be much easier to do. I mean, you could balance it because you bring everybody to the room together. But when you have, you know, the activities of the feds and the states and the counties and the cities all doing this, that coordination can get out of balance very quickly. Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity and for your consideration.
Hey, Representative Hansen had a question.
Yeah, hopefully these will be a couple slow pitch softballs for you. But,
appreciate it.
When counties were having to reduce budgets under Measure 5047, it seemed to me that what was happening, the dynamic, was that district attorneys' budgets were protected as much as possible by the counties, and there were the cuts that had to be made were happening in the county sheriff, deputies, other areas, but I think counties did during the mid-90s pretty much protect the district attorneys as much as they could. Is that still continuing, or is it possible for counties to continue to do that, or are you actually starting to see now cuts in the district attorney's budget?
Chairman Miller, Representative Hansen, in Josephine County, that wasn't the case. Part of what happened was district attorneys' positions were lost in order to put people on the road. But we also closed a library, which was the first library ever closed in Oregon. And I was one of those commissioners that did it. I survived. It was tough, but it was one of those unfortunate type situations. But I think now, even with some of the things that are happening, it's going to be more and more difficult to try to preserve positions of prosecution or in the areas of sheriff. One of our goals here is that in bringing the level of funding up from the state, if you participated at least at the beginning level, I'll use our county as an example, that would be about 100 and some odd thousand, $180,000, $90,000 that would come back into our county. Under the formula we've set out, 30% of that would stay within the DA's office. We would pull some of our general fund back. That money would go into bringing on deputy sheriffs that we need. We're going to lose deputy sheriffs. We have to keep the same level of funding that we're getting this year's budget and try to move forward next year. We're going to lose 12 deputies. Can't afford to do that. We have a COPS grant, but those are starting to come due now, and part of that COPS grant funding requires you to carry the load afterwards. And we've been able to get some extension in that, but it's going to get some. There's going to be some real hard decisions that are going to be made, at least in our county.
Overall, what's the percentage of county revenues, you know, maybe Balkan tells it, that goes to public safety.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, it varies between 65% and 80% of the total county general fund. Usually it's right around 70% that goes to public safety in some form or another of the total county general fund.
I guess one of my overall concerns is as we cut the state budgets and state police, courts, there's sort of a feeling that somehow this work will get done or get carried on, and it's not going to happen from the counties because the dollars just aren't there. And yet, they're the other part of the partnership.
Senator Miller, Representative Hansen, I would agree with that, and I think one of the, of course, our request is that somewhere along the line is $20 million be put into this program. I guess one of the things that I would think we want to look at is the performance capabilities. I truly believe that if we were to able to have those dollars brought in and the state was to become a partner at a higher level, that I think we could put law enforcement people on the street faster and provide the kind of protection that the people are asking for out in our communities at a price that's not quite the cost that the state would have to if they were to bring other additional law enforcement officers. But I truly believe that we could be held to some kind of performance standard and come back in the next legislative session to show you just how we were able to do that. And I think that would then solidify the trueness of our efforts to become a real good partner in this whole process.
All right. Well, we thank you for coming up.
Thank you.
I've been working with several of our DAs on a concept called fast track accountability. Have you folks heard of this?
Yes.
Would you be willing to comment on where you would stand in if the legislator introduced that as a bill?
I believe that we're with the district attorneys on that issue.
Do you think there's a savings to be had for the state of Oregon by introducing fast track accountability?
My understanding in the discussions that I've been involved in, that there would be some. But I don't know the number. I'm not sure of that number.
Just as a comment, Chair. I forwarded a letter to Chairman Miller and the co-chairs, you know, along with the Speaker and the President, letting them know that I think there's an opportunity for the state to save money through fast-track accountability. The way this process works is for folks who commit misdemeanor crimes, it would allow them to come forward initially, admit their guilt, have a set penalty handed to them, and allow them to move on. I'm of the opinion that it would save the taxpayers' dollars through greater efficiencies and freeing up court time. I had a chance to talk with the Speaker last night about this. My initial thought was to try and do a committee bill. He said, no, we're not going to be doing committee bills, but he's going to be working with me to find another avenue to pursue this. And so in the coming days, I look forward to bringing back to you folks the work I'm trying to do on that.
Well, thank you. And thank you again.
Just another quick ending note is the Association of Oregon Counties really, really is interested in working with you as legislative folks. And we are all elected officials. We all serve the same people. And I think our common desire is to provide the best services and protection to the citizens of Oregon. And we're here to try to do that in any fashion that we can. Whether I'm on as past president, he's president. Representative Hansen, of course, was the past president. We're here to provide the same kind of services that you want to provide.
Well, we appreciate that, and we'll hopefully take you up on that invitation.
All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very
much. Okay. Well, now we'll move into a work session on House Bill 5013. Mr. Nyswender.
Yes. Chair Miller, committee members, when we left off yesterday, there was some discussion about the fast-track accountability and the potential for a budget note. And as Representative Smith has spoken today, there will be an effort made to address that through policy legislation, so there isn't one drafted to present to you today. What I have placed in front of you is a copy of the work session papers and a cover memo, which describes LFO's recommendations for this budget. And essentially, there are two changes that are recommended based on the adjustments to the PERS employer contribution rate and the DAS central government of service charges. As mentioned in public testimony, this is a current service level budget, and this would make a total reduction of approximately, $13,509 general fund based on those two without any other recommended changes.
Thank you, Mr. Nyswender. Now, Marla Ray, you have one pitch that we're going to reject.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Marla Ray representing Oregon's district attorneys. I'm hoping that the introduction was just a misstatement, but I wanted to remind you of a discussion we had yesterday. In the event the committee is so inclined to discuss priorities for some ad hoc list,
yes.
So I didn't want that little issue to be forgotten.
Which little issue?
I appreciate that.
The ad back list.
The ad back and prioritizing.
Little tiny issue. And as the discussion was yesterday, the recommended order was first for the restructuring of counties for salary purposes, and second, increased state support for prosecution services.
We thank you for that.
And thank you for the donut.
Apparently, they didn't purchase silence.
That's his real motive. We've all been failing.
Okay, you've heard Mr. Nyswender's recommendations.
Yes, and in order to make the amendments necessary, they're described in the memo. We would have to delete in section one the dollar amount that's in the bill as its original printed form and insert $6,673,619 for the DA's salary portion. And in section four, the part that deals with administrative costs that Department of Justice receives for processing the budget, paying central government service charges, would be reduced from $403,000 down to $402,359.
Is there a discussion of the proposed amendments to House Bill 5013? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, it is adopted. Now, House Bill 5013 is ready to be forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. And Senator Trost so moves. Is there a discussion? Representative Hansen.
Well, quick discussion. This is an inadequate budget, but it fits with the rest of the SAP.
Yeah, right. The inadequate budget.
That's right.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think we all agree with that.
Excuse me?
I think we all agree with that, and we regret the fact that we can't do better.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, with Senator regard Crow? To the possibility of a budget note for first-tracked accountability, I just wonder if Representative Smith thinks it might make sense to have one just in case the legislation doesn't make it through the process.
I would defer to your expertise on that. What I've been told is the DAs are excited about this idea, and they're willing to move forward with it. The dilemma is there's other entities out there that we'd also have to include budget notes in their documents to have them come to the table as well.
You know, I haven't heard any discussion of the other side of the issue, if there is another side of the issue. It really sounds good to me at this point, but my guess is there will be some discussion of the whole range of issues that has to get through some judiciary committees and so forth. And some counties are already doing it. And if somehow or other it doesn't get through, then I wonder if that throws cold water on what counties are already doing, unless we have a budget note which says somehow or other that we think this is an attractive concept that ought to be looked into. Maybe that's all we say.
Leonard, if we did that, and I've just been listening so far, I would want to understand better that this is not some kind of a process that somehow defendants' rights are fully protected. That is, as I've heard the discussion, I haven't heard that portion of it, and I would want to, before I agreed to a budget note, I would want to fully understand that somehow we weren't rushing defendants into some conviction that they might otherwise not do.
Chairman. From what I heard was that the defense counsel has at least preliminarily given approval to this. So,
Chairman Miller, Representative Leonard, the way this would work is it would provide another avenue for the person who's accused of the crime to say, hey, listen, I know I did this. I know I'm going to say I'm guilty, rather than going through the whole headache of having to go through the court system. I'm just going to say, yes, I did it, and take my punishment and move on. And that it's a fast track through the process. They fully have the option to say, no, I did not do this crime, and then to exercise their rights. So
I would like to hear the perspective
of course.
The defense attorney, just to make sure that I fully understood what I'm voting on.
This is a very valuable discussion. It's my understanding the co-chairs are more interested in a statutory approach than a budget note, and not that they necessarily dictate our actions. They have some influence. Representative Hanson.
Well, another possible avenue in terms of the cooperation that's going to be needed to get this forward. I think we can probably get an update on the progress that's being made before, if we ever get to a position of actually proceeding with add-backs or finding more revenue. And I think that might be another area of leverage that we might have in terms of moving this idea forward.
Next week, all interested parties are going to be sitting down, at least have been invited to sit down at a table next Thursday with Robin. We're going to sit down and walk through this whole piece, and I believe Speaker Simmons is going to have a member from his office come, and I think he actually intends to be the carrier of the legislation.
For further discussion of the motion to move House Bill 5013 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, it is so ordered. Is there anything further to come before the committee?
There's carriers.
Carriers. Want me to pass a draw some straws here?
It's going to die right here for lack of a carrier.
Representative Canope, you need some floor time?
I don't, but I'm happy to carry for you, sir.
All right, I thank you for
what
that.
What floor time he's had, he's abused.
You want
be fine or right, whatever you want.
All right, Senator Crowe, thank you very much. We appreciate this. There's nothing further to come before the committee. We are adjourned. We'll see you Monday.
Public defender.